Apparently when sheep are taken off to be killed, they sometimes instinctively know that the abattoir is a bad place for them. They might be able to smell something or sense something which warns them of the danger. And so the truck will stop and the gangplank will come down, but the sheep refuse to move. From what I've been told, and I've read this in a few places, the abattoir workers have devised a way around this problem. They keep a sheep or a goat at the abattoir, one who's used to it now and doesn't mind the place anymore, and they take this pet up onto the truck, and then it walks back down again, leading the other sheep with it. The other sheep, seeing one of their own, will now feel that it's safe to follow. The abattoir workers call this sheep the Judas. For many, many years, many, many people have been fascinated by Judas. We wonder, what must he have gone through? Why did he do what he did? Did he have any choice in that? Or, like the sheep at the abattoir, was that his destiny, something that he had to do? For many years, many people have been fascinated by the idea, by the person of Judas. In 2006, National Geographic magazine announced that a gospel had been discovered which was reported to be an account of Jesus written by none other than Judas. In preparing for tonight, I got a copy of the Gospel of Judas. Like many people, I was really interested to read what it said. And right from the first words, it makes its claim. The 11 other disciples, the 11 other apostles were deluded. They worshipped Jesus, who they thought to be the true God. Jesus, however, wasn't the true God, according to the Gospel of Judas. In fact, according to this Gospel, Jesus actually took Judas aside a few days before he went to the cross, and Jesus revealed to Judas the truth about spiritual worlds and about deities, over which Judas himself would become the true ruler and leader. Jesus made it clear no one from the 11 disciples had true knowledge. Judas would be a great high priest who would sacrifice the body of Jesus and be elevated to glory. That's what the Gospel of Judas is about. Now, I've got to say, unearthing this gospel was a really important discovery. Even though no scholar anywhere believes it was actually written by Judas, and no scholar anywhere believes this is what Jesus actually taught, even though experts believe it comes from a time well after the apostles, so it's essentially a fake, still, even with all of that, it's a really important discovery, because it shows us that for many centuries, many people have been fascinated with and had conspiracy theories about Judas. Incidentally, when National Geographic said that it announced in 2006 that it had been discovered, and they did a big feature story on it, one thing that wasn't evident to lots of people was that the Gospel of Judas had actually been discovered back in the 1970s in Egypt. It's just National Geographic, for whatever reason, had waited 36 years before they picked up on it and did a full cover spread. See, even with all of that stuff, it's still an important discovery, though, because it shows that for many years, many people have been fascinated by and had conspiracy theories about Judas. But what can we learn from Judas? What is his relevance for us today? What is the Judas episode all about? Well, tonight we're not going to look at that gospel, because as I say, no one believes it was actually by him. Tonight we're going to look at another place where we find out about Judas. We're going to look at John's gospel tonight, and we're going to look at Jesus' last night before he goes to the cross. And there, we're going to attempt to learn three lessons, or understand three things, or know three facts about Judas and the episode of Judas. We're going to see Jesus' control, number one, human betrayal, number two, and Jesus caring for his own. So three things we learn from this episode of Judas: Jesus' control, human betrayal, and Jesus caring for his own. First of all then, have a look at verse 18. "I am not referring to all of you," Jesus said. "I know those whom I have chosen, But this is to fulfill the scripture, he who shares my bread has lifted up his heel against me. So even as he's being betrayed, and even as he's been arrested, he's been tried in court, he's eventually killed on the cross, even as all of this stuff goes down, John makes special mention, he goes right out of his way to be deliberate about Jesus' full control. John shows how much Jesus is in charge. It's all in his hands. Not that it was ever out of his control, not that, you know, somehow he'd lost charge or something like that. It's just that, think about it, when somebody is arrested and when somebody is betrayed and arrested and then tried in a court and then they put to death on a cross, when that stuff happens to somebody, we naturally think they lost it. We naturally think they didn't mean for that to happen. That went beyond what they could manage. You know, they lost control. So John wants to show us, no way, not at all. Even with all of that going on around him, Jesus is just as much in charge as ever. For starters, there's verse 18. See what it says there? Jesus didn't choose the 12 and then later on figure out one of them was the devil. Like, I knew it. Yeah, like a game of Cluedo. Like Colonel Mustard in the library with the candlestick. I knew it. Gotcha. You know, or watching CSI and we're watching the episode and then we find out who it was at the end. No, that's not what happens here. He knew all along those who he had chosen. He knew who they were. He knew what they would do to him. He knew how Judas would betray him. He knew how Peter would betray him as well, for that matter. And he still chose them anyway, even knowing all those things about them. Way back in chapter 6, verse 7, we're told that Judas was a devil. In chapter 6, 7. In chapter 12, verse 4, we're told Judas would betray him. Even in our chapter that we're looking at tonight, a few weeks ago, we already learnt that the devil had put straight into the heart the temptation of Judas. That's in 13:2. All along, Jesus knew about this. He spoke about it all along. He's presented as knowing all of that all along. See the rest of 18? The rest of 18 says, I'm not referring to all of you, I know who I've chosen, but this is to fulfill the scripture, he who shares my bread has lifted up his heel against me. Someone would betray me in order that the scriptures might be fulfilled. Psalm 40. Someone would turn me in, and that was to bring about God's plan. See, Jesus is the great Lord in the line, the family line of David. Just as David, who wrote that psalm, suffered at the hands of his loved friends, Jesus would too. What happened to David would happen to Jesus, because Jesus would be a king, lord, ruler, like David was. No, you could actually say Jesus would be a king, lord, ruler, greater than David. And so Jesus' control is seen in that way. He knows exactly who it is, and he knows that they will betray him. And not that Jesus, not that Judas had no choice. We'll get to that in a minute. He's not just an innocent person trapped in his destiny, you know, an innocent person trying to get out. We'll get to that in a minute. But for starters, we see Jesus knows who it is, and who it is going to betray. Now that's not all. Jesus' control is also seen in verse 19. See there, 19. I am telling you now before it happens, so that when it does happen, you'll believe that I am he. How's that for control? He doesn't just know what's about to happen to him. He's even going to use that knowledge for their good and well-being. He will use what is happening to him to help his disciples. And so rather than Judas wrecking their faith and them all going, I can't believe this has happened. I'm in shock. This is making me doubt the whole thing. Rather than wrecking their faith, Judas' betrayal is actually going to confirm their faith and strengthen their faith, because Jesus said, "That's I'm telling you in advance, so that that's what will happen." That's how in control he is. That's how in charge he is of this situation. He uses the Judas episode for their good. A little later on, there's a strange moment. I've always wondered about this. The soldiers come to arrest Jesus. some of you will know this from reading John before. And they come to arrest him, and they're armed, and there's a large group of them. And then all of a sudden, everyone just falls to the ground, and Jesus just is standing there over them. And again, in that moment, you actually see the utter control that Jesus has over this situation. He's not out of control, hasn't got out of hand. They fall around at his feet, and he stands there. There's another moment where Jesus is on trial before Pilate, and he says quite truthfully, I could have an enormous army of utterly terrifying supernatural beings come down and defend me if I wanted to, but I choose not to, is effect what he's saying. These are just little examples, but they're other examples from John to show how much he's in control. Even as he's being betrayed, even as he's being arrested, even as he's being tried, even as he's being put to death on the cross. Jesus' control. Now from this, of course, the obvious question comes up, like some big questions come up from Judas, I think. And that's why often we're so interested in him. But one of the obvious ones is, why doesn't Jesus stop him? Like, if Jesus knew what Judas was going to do, then why not stop him? If Jesus was in complete control, then why wouldn't you stop him? Or allow it to be done some other way so that he doesn't have to get betrayed. So it's the obvious question, isn't it? If you know what's going to happen, then do something about it, Jesus. Why doesn't Jesus stop him? Because this is why Jesus came into the world, to die. The world would not receive him, and so that is why he came into the world, because it would not receive him. The world would betray him, and so that's why he came into the world, to be betrayed. What I'm trying to say is that God knew of the world's rejection and betrayal, and so he sent his son into the world in order to be rejected and betrayed. Because when that happens, it's going to be clear to everybody just how far we've fallen and just what we as people have become, that the Son of God comes into the world and we reject him. So it makes it clear. God sent Jesus in the world to make it clear what we've become. But not just make it clear, this is all part of God's plan to save. Jesus died for us to rescue us from our betrayal and to rescue us from how we've turned our back on him. Judas is chosen to be an apostle. That is true. And even though Jesus knows his wickedness from the start, in his wickedness, he would be part of God's overall plan to save the world. I remember a few weeks ago we saw Jesus putting on his jacket and returning to his seat after he'd washed the disciples' feet. And that was a really important moment because we once again got to see Jesus for who he really is, that when he put that jacket on and went back to his seat, you could see, whoa, he's the Lord. And he was once again presented to us as Jesus the Lord. Not that we'd forget that normally. Normally you don't have any problems thinking of Jesus as the Lord. But it's just that the whole chapter up to that point had actually had Jesus on his knees serving. And serving in a really, lowly and menial way. And so John had to make an effort. John had to give us a reminder of who Jesus really was, that he was the Lord. See, Jesus has kingly authority and he serves. Jesus serves, yeah, but he also has great authority, which is what John was reminding us of at that time. He is the Lord and a servant. And our passage tonight is saying a very similar thing. Our passage tonight is really well placed after that foot washing because it's saying something really similar to that foot washing. Jesus is in control. And with his control, he chooses the 12. He even allows a betrayer so that through that, Jesus may be led to serve and die for the world. See that? His control, his authority, and his lowly service are all happening there in the one thing. Look, if there's still any doubt, if you're thinking, what is this about? Look at verse 27. Verse 27 says, as soon as Jesus took the bread, Satan entered into him. What you are about to do, do quickly. He knows Judas is the betrayer. He even knows when Judas goes past the point of no return. He even knows when Judas has got to the point, there's no going back. And so he tells him, get on with it. After extending this final act of love and friendship to Judas, which is, that's what's happening, a last chance, he now tells him, go. That's the control. that Jesus has in this moment, in this situation. So what does Judas teach us, guys? What do we learn from Judas? What understanding do we gain from Judas? Well, first of all, this episode is teaching us Jesus' full and complete control in good times and in bad, when things are crazy and when they're quiet. It's never out of hand. He hasn't lost his grip. He was and always will be in charge. If ever there was a time to say, oh, I think he's lost it. If ever there was a time to think, oh, he's fumbled the ball. Oh, you know, it's got out of hand. If ever there was a time, well, here's the time, with the betrayer in his midst and kicking off a chain of events that will lead to the cross. If ever there's a time, and yet John is showing us, here we see his control all the more. Now, sometimes we need to be told, or I don't know, commanded, given a loud exhortation to trust in Jesus. Sometimes we really need somebody to come into our room and throw back the curtains and rip off the doona and stick a coffee in our hand and say, now trust in Jesus, and away you go. We need to be told that. Sometimes we need a spur along, you know, and that's part of why you come to church, or that's part of why you go to Bible study sometimes. You need someone to do what we might call a kick in the bum. Like, come on, trust in Jesus. You're a Christian, what are you doing? And away we go. Sometimes we need something else, though, a different message. It's actually worded the same. It sounds pretty similar, but there's actually quite a different meaning. Rather than you should trust Jesus, sometimes what we need to hear is Jesus can be trusted. An example of this is someone who's very downcast or depressed, perhaps someone who often goes through depression. They're a Christian believer, but they've had a harder than average road to walk. They've been through more than the rest of us, perhaps. And now, due to a whole heap of things going on in their life, a combination of things, they're very downcast, having a depressed time. Mental ill health, losing sleep, conflict, bad habits, a bad event, doubts about Christianity, family troubles, whatever it is. All of them together, and they're feeling quite downcast. And into that, a well-meaning church friend or a well-meaning family member will say, you should trust Jesus more. They throw back the curtains and they rip off the doona and stick a coffee in their hand and say, come on, you should trust Jesus more. And they are the person, the well-meaning person, they care. That's why they're doing it, because they're well-meaning and they care, and they mean well. So they want to stir up the person to have more faith. An exhortation like that, like I say, it can be really good. And next week we're going to see Jesus himself does it to the disciples. He says, "Do not let your hearts be troubled. Trust in God. Trust also in me. Trust in Jesus Christ." So he does it. So sometimes it can be really good and right, but we're not Jesus, and we can't often see exactly what's going on. In our hands, sometimes saying things like that, you should trust in Jesus, that can be very good, but sometimes it can only make matters worse. Rather than help someone who is downcast, it can actually put them in a worse situation, because it makes them say, I need to trust more. It throws them back on themselves and their resources and their strength and their energy to see if they can come up with more faith and if they can come up with more trust. I have to trust more. I've got to stir this up. The trouble is, if they're going through a depressed patch, they may have nothing more to give. The well is dry, the tank is empty. They're in a different situation to Jesus and his disciples when Jesus says that to them later on in the chapter. These people might feel like they can't really give much anymore. It's just going to be yet another failure to them. Go on their big mountain of failures. All the things that they can't do well. Oh, I can't even trust. For a strong, confident Christian looking on in that situation, they see the person get even more discouraged. You should trust Jesus more. The person gets even more discouraged. And to them, to a strong, confident, fit Christian, that can then become a sign that the person isn't really a believer, or a sign that the person hasn't actually got a good faith or a proper faith. Rather than saying, you need to trust Jesus more, perhaps a safer way when you're dealing with the downcast is just to simply say, Jesus can be trusted. He's in control. He's in charge. Jesus can be trusted. And that's this passage, isn't it? That's this in good and in bad. When it's crazy and when it's quiet. Hasn't lost his grip. He hasn't let go. If ever there was a time to say, you know, Jesus has lost it, well, here it is right here. But here, what do we see? His control all the more. Jesus can be trusted. Rather than asking the downcast to do something, it's simply putting that good and comforting word in their lap and then walking away and letting it settle in. On a different note, some Christians aren't downcast or going through a time of depression, but there are some Christians who just can't seem to find any peace about what it means to be a Christian. Like I say, they're not depressed. It's just that something doesn't click right for them about the Christian life. And so they read lots of Christian books trying to understand the secret to the Christian life, the way that the Christian life works. And these books, they're everywhere. And they'll say, thankfulness. The key is thankfulness. As a people, we're not thankful enough, but we should be thankful to God. Are you thankful? And they go, no, I don't think I am, actually. You need to be more thankful. And they go, right, okay, thankfulness. And away they go. It could be thankfulness as the big thing that they have to... Or joyful. We're not joyful toward God. Are you joyful? No, I'm not joyful. You be more joyful. Or it could be discipline or generosity. Like I say, the bookstore is full of all of these books on what you need to be more of in order to really understand God, in order to really understand Jesus, in order to be able to go. And again, here is someone who particularly benefits from hearing this. Not so much, you need to trust Jesus. They're getting all that from their books. And they're trying to stir that up in themselves. Not, you need to. But simply, look, Jesus can be trusted. For some of you here tonight, that's you, isn't it? That's right where you're at. You have had a harder than average road to walk, right? You have had plenty of rough patches. You are in a rough patch now. Right? Or maybe you're one of those book people and you're finding being a Christian really confusing. Isn't there something more that I have to do? It doesn't feel right. Maybe I need to be more thankful. As a church, we want to say to you, if that is you, we want to say to you, Jesus can be trusted. See his control? See how he's in charge? At the point where everything seems to be falling down around him, he's got it. Totally covered. We're not telling you, as a church, we're not saying to you, you need to go out and do something necessarily. We're just putting this here for you. As a church, we say to you tonight, Jesus can be trusted. And we're happy to say that. We like to say that. That's one of our favourite things to say. So I hope you'll hear it, if that's you. For others of you here, you know, maybe you're not one of those confused book readers or somebody who is downcast at the moment. Maybe you're counselling somebody who is a confused Christian, or you're counselling somebody who's feeling downcast. As you counsel someone, as you spend time with someone who has doubts, bring this in. Make this a tool in your tool belt as you're chatting with those people. Listen as they talk to you. And then when you've listened, listen some more. And then when you've listened, listen some more still. And then if you're given a chance to speak, and if you've had a chance to hear what they've said properly, then after all of that, you might say, yeah, and Jesus can be trusted. Look, let me show you how Jesus can be trusted. Such a good thing to do. Such a gift to give. Such a good news to give to people. But though he's in control, though he's in charge, though he can be trusted, that doesn't mean that it's all easy for him. I'd hate for you to think that. Though Jesus, you know, stands there later on while everyone literally falls around him, that doesn't mean that it's all smooth sailing and that Jesus is like, ha-ha, see, fall over. In fact, what we're going to see now is things are very difficult. for Jesus. And that's our second point. So point one is human Jesus control. That's point one. Point two, human betrayal. We're learning lessons from Judas, and point two is human betrayal. Look at verse 21. After he had said this, Jesus was troubled in spirit and testified, "I tell you the truth, one of you is going to betray me." You see what's going on there? After he's shown his control to them, and after he's revealed his insight and his knowledge, after he said all those things to let us know how much he's in charge, then he's visibly stirred up. It's the same word used of Mary when she throws herself to the ground after her brother Lazarus has died. She's stirred, she's in anguish. It's actually the same word used back in chapter 5 of water, where the waters are churned up by an angel so that people can get down into them. And that's Jesus. Once he expresses his control, then he moves on to express his great anguish, because it's both of these things together at the same time in him. Yeah, he's in control, but that doesn't mean that it's easy, smooth sailing and kind of ha-ha, superhero. No, he's troubled, he's falling, he's churned up like the water. Because the one who shares my bread, so close that we share bread together, is also the one who is lifting up his heel to kick me in the face. To share bread together, that's eating together. That's a sign of unity and companionship. It's a sign of someone being very close to you to share bread. So the one who is my close friend is lifting up the foot to kick at me. That's why it causes such great anguish. Even though Jesus is in control, to go through that. The small details of verse 23, 24, 25. This little strange little conversation here, that's really important if you have a look at those verses. See, in verse 23, Peter signals to John and goes, "Ask him who will betray," and does a sort of a whisper across. And then John, who was on Jesus' right-hand side here, we think leaning on his elbow, sort of leaned back to Jesus and said, "Who is it?" And then Jesus gives him the quiet answer, "The one who's going to take this bread." That explains to us why none of the other disciples know. When Judas goes out into the night, none of the other disciples are aware of what's going on, because only John was the one to hear it. See verse 28 there? Just look at 28. But no one at the meal understood why Jesus said this to him. Since Judas had charge of the money, some thought Jesus was telling him to buy what he needed for the feast or to give something to the poor. As soon as Judas had taken the bread, he went out and it was night. See, these details explain why none of the other disciples catch the fact that Judas is the betrayer, and they're caught off guard. But it actually also lets us see something else. Judas was probably right there next to Jesus. See how easy it is for Jesus to extend the bread to him? Jesus doesn't have to get up and walk around to the other side and give the bread to him. Most commentaries think that Judas was probably sitting right there next to him, John on one side and Judas on the other. And if that were the case, that would be pretty important, because to sit at the right and the left hand of Jesus, that is a place of honour. And so here is one sitting in the place of honour, if that is right, who would go on to betray him for 30 pieces of silver, dipping the bread and handing it over. Now that's an act of love, because it's saying, "Eat with me, join with me." It wasn't just some symbolic thing, like Jesus goes, the one who has my car keys, no, the one who eats this bread and just grabbed whatever he could find. To actually hand that bread over, that's to say, "Come, you know, come and eat with me, be one with me." See, at the end there, "Do it quick." Do you see how he says it there at the end? What you have to do quickly. That's the sort of thing that you get in movies. You know, the guy, something horrible has to be done, a guy has to be finished off, and he says, "Do it quick." And, you know, that kind of thing. It's a horrible thing you have to do. For Jesus, this is a horrible thing he's telling Judas to go and do. Do it, go and do it quickly. Let's get this over and done with. All of this adds up to what? tally it up, do the maths, or, you know, what's the picture that we're getting here? We're getting, even though Jesus is in control, even though he's fully in charge, he's not removed from the situation, he's not untouched, the opposite is true. Judas' betrayal stirs him, it troubles him, it churns him up. The one who shares my bread has raised his heel against me. One commentary says this, it was really good, says, Jesus is deeply troubled by the knowledge that one of his own disciples is about to betray him. 3 years of close friendship has failed to win Judas' love and loyalty. To make matters worse, it's all undetected by the other disciples. To know full well the deceitfulness of a friend and to have to bear all that alone to the very end reveals a remarkable restraint. In other words, after 3 years, after much love and patience, after having Jesus wash his feet, hasn't turned around. Judas is still set for what he wants to do. As I said before, you know, lots of big questions come up from Judas. The most obvious one being, well, why doesn't Jesus stop him? If Jesus knew what he was going to do, why not stop him? Answer, because that is why Jesus has come into the world, to die. When Jesus chooses the 12, he even allows a betrayer so that Jesus may be led to serve the world. But then that raises an even more difficult question. If Judas is the betrayer and was meant to be the betrayer, did he have a choice? If this is what had to happen for God's plan to go ahead, then is Judas even responsible? Was Judas ever free? Or was he like an innocent person but caged in this plan of God and he just had to go through with it? Was Judas ever free? The answer is both yes and no. Jesus is completely free, but in a way that would never compromise Judas as a free person. Jesus is completely in charge, but in a way that doesn't stop Judas being a free person. And then you can say it the other way around. Judas is completely free, but not in a way that would ever make God's plans reversible, so that Judas would change his mind and now God's plans can't go ahead. And both are true at the same time. And you need both to be true. Jesus completely in charge, but not compromising Judas as a free person. Judas completely free to act, but not in a way that would unravel God's plans. And both are true at the same time. Jesus control, there could be no other way. He had to be in control. Judas doing exactly what he wants to do, there can be no other way. And both are true at the same time. If we take away the truth that Judas was a responsible and free person and we only ever talk about how much Jesus was in charge, then it does raise massive questions over whether God was really right to do this. You know, choosing him and determining his lot and making it happen that way. On the other hand, if we only ever talk about how Judas was free and miss out on how much Jesus was in charge, and only emphasize how much Judas is free, then you could get into a situation where even God is dependent on what Judas chooses. And where even God has to sort of wait around and go, well, is he going to take the bread? Okay, he took the bread. Whew. Okay, the plans can go ahead. When Jesus extends that offer of love and friendship to Judas one last time, it's a genuine offer. Come and eat with me. Be in partnership with me. And yet, it's always true that Judas would never accept that, and that he personally didn't want to accept that. So if all this sounds like a bit of a muddle and a bit of a mess, then here's a couple of things that might help. Number one, this view actually has a name, where you actually emphasise God is completely in control, but not in a way that wrecks human freedom, and humans are completely free, but not in a way that wrecks God's control. This view has a name. It's called compatibilism. Because Jesus being in charge is compatible with Judas being free. Both are true at once. They're compatible. Sometimes just hearing that a view has a name makes me feel better. Okay, compatibilism. This must be a thing. And I'm more ready and eager to listen to it rather than just going, is that guy making that up? You should also know that compatibilism is held by many different philosophers, Christians and otherwise, and many different people all over the world. So that's the first thing to say. Number two, though we know both are true of these statements, you know, Jesus control, but in a way that doesn't wreck Judas' freedom, Judas free, but not in a way that wrecks Jesus' control. Though we know these are true and compatible, we don't know exactly how they do fit together. So how can Judas completely be free while Jesus is in control? And how can Judas, you know, not do anything other than betray Jesus? And yet this is exactly what Judas wants to do. We don't know how they fit together, how they operate. But then finally, number three, though we can't understand the mystery, right, we can actually still take a lot of confidence and not feel ripped off about it. Because we might not be able to understand the exact mystery, but we can point to the mystery. We can actually point to where the mystery is in our thinking. We can know what we do know, and then we can know these things that we can't know. We can do a study of other topics around it, topics that kind of affect what the answer will be, and we can get more information about these other topics, like how does God relate to evil, or how does God relate to time, and things like that. We can study these topics carefully to more clearly explain what the question is. Even if we can't explain what the answer is, we'll still be left with the mystery. But when we're finished, what we've done is locate the mystery even better in our thinking, so we're not sloppy about it. We're actually crystal clear what we know and what we don't know. We've shown that there is an answer, even if we don't know exactly what the answer is. After 3 years, after much love and patience, after having Jesus wash his own feet, according to God's plan and according to what Judas wants, he betrays Jesus, and Jesus is deeply troubled by it. He is stirred up from it. Judas responds to Jesus' love with rejection. That's what betrayal is. That's what toll it takes. That's what price is paid. The God-man, the Son, the Lord of glory, he's troubled. It's pretty significant to say that. He's upset. He's saddened. Perhaps you can even say he has a broken heart. Next week we're going to see that Judas is not the only one. But next week we're going to see that Peter betrays him too. In fact, all the disciples run away. What's the difference between Judas and Peter? You know, they all betrayed him. So why does Judas get such a deal? You know, there are some really obvious differences between Judas and Peter. Judas betrays Jesus in the ultimate way. Peter does not. Judas wants that because he plans it and he premeditates it. Peter does not. Peter laments after he's done it, and repents and is restored by Jesus himself. So there's some obvious differences between Judas and Peter. But you know, there are some similarities too. There is a shared spirit too, isn't there? They both looked after themselves first. They both hung Jesus out to dry and said, sorry, not with me. In the case of Peter, he cared more about what others thought of him. So yeah, there are big differences. And Peter shared something of the Judas spirit. Do you know we all do? We all share that. There are obvious differences that make Judas unique, one off very, very different from us all. But we all have times when we turn our face away from him, when we stay silent when we should speak, when we're ashamed of him in this generation. Like Peter, we disown Jesus, or we have done at some stage. And like Peter, we need to be sorry. Like Peter, we need forgiveness from Jesus. We need Jesus to bring forgiveness to us and let us turn back to him. And one of the hardest times to stay true to Jesus is when you're in a new situation. So, you know, it's a new workplace at the CBD, and from the very start you're trying to impress people and feeling a little bit nervous. Or it's a new school. You're heading off to Ogilvy or Hobart College, or starting a new school next year, meeting a new group of people. Everybody else knows everybody else. Everyone else is confident. In Peter's case, you know, he was around the fire with servants and soldiers who were all supposed to be there. He wasn't supposed to be there. And even though Jesus was still with him, and even though Peter should have been able to look to Jesus, because Peter and Jesus could see one another, he should have been able to look to him and take comfort and trust in Jesus' control. He didn't. He actually looked with his human eyes, and he saw that Jesus was under arrest, and one thing led to another. He denied Jesus. He didn't plan it like Judas did, but he did. We all need to be forgiven. We all need to know the situations where we're going to be tempted to deny Jesus. And we need to pray for courage and for Jesus himself by his Spirit to strengthen us in those times. You know, you're on the way to a family barbecue and you'll know there'll be a temptation to be ashamed of Jesus because of Uncle. And you know how Uncle's always, you know, going on and on and on and on and on and on and on about it. And Uncle's always trying to start something. And you know how easy it is just to shrink away. And you say, Lord, please help me. The temptation to be ashamed of Jesus when you're on the school bus and everybody's doing what is not right and people are saying what they shouldn't say and they look at you and they say, and you're a Christian, and they challenge you, say, you don't like what we're doing now. And it would be so easy to say, oh, I don't care. Being Christian is nothing to me. And in a subtle way, it's just a little move, a little denial, a little move away from Jesus. So you're on the school bus and instead just, Lord, help me. Give me the right word to say at the right time. The friends are having a big drinking session on a big camping trip with the boys. The temptation there is to turn away for a weekend or two. We've been learning from Judas, and what have we seen? Jesus' control, yep. Spirit of betrayal, yep. And then finally, Jesus' care for his own, because he really does care for his own. Jesus will answer the prayer for courage when you pray for it. Jesus will not leave us all alone to the wolves. He was there with Peter. Peter should have trusted in him, and he will be there for us as well. And so that's point three, his care for his own. Have a look at 27. As soon as Judas took the bread, Satan entered into him. What you're about to do, do quickly, Jesus told him. But no one at the meal understood why Jesus said this to him. Since Judas had charge of the money, some thought that he was telling him to go buy what was needed for the feast or to give something to the poor. As soon as Judas had taken the bread, he went out and it was night. Ever there's going to be a time for you to love, for these guys to love Jesus, the time was right now. Now, every time to put your hand on his shoulder and say, I pray for you, Jesus, time is now. They're going to do a kind word, go out of the way. Yeah, here it is. This is the night to do it. Because as we've been saying throughout this series, it's the last night of Jesus. It's his final moment. He's going to lay down his life like a seed. He's going to fall into the ground and die to produce many other seeds. And so if ever there's a night for them to, you know, just rally around, here's the night. But you get none of that. It's the other way around. Right, he's serving them, isn't he? He's looking after them. He's caring for their needs and tending to their needs, washing their feet. We saw this a few weeks ago. That was a display of how much he loved them. He did it because he really loved them. And it was also a symbol of how he was going to wash away all their sins. It was a display of his love and a symbol of the cleansing that he would bring to them by dying on the cross. But, you know, he's not just going to clean each of them individually. And he's not just going to look after them each on their own. He's also going to look after them as a group and as a people. He calls them, he says, you are my own. You're the ones who God has given me in the world. And so sending Judas away is actually a kind of cleansing. Not in terms of, you know, getting sin out of each of them individually, but it's a cleansing in terms of getting sin out of his people and making sure that his people are truly his own who are in the world. Just see verse 17. We did this a few weeks ago. Verse 17. Now that you know these things, that's washing each other's feet, now that you know these things, you will be blessed if you do them. I'm not referring to all of you. I know those who I have chosen. I tell you the truth, verse 20, whoever accepts anyone I send accepts me, and whoever accepts me accepts the one I send. See, once Judas is cast out, now he's going to really start to teach his disciples. And we see that next week. Once Judas is cast out, he's going to pray for his disciples. In particular, he's going to pray that they remain true to God in the world. Once Judas is cast out, he says, I'm always going to be with you right to the very end. He calls them my little children. He calls them my friends. Now, until Judas goes, he has to keep on saying, oh, but not every one of you. So we go, you are my own in the world. Oh, but not every one of you. You are my children. Oh, but not every one of you. He has to keep on reminding that there is one there in the midst. And that one in the midst forces him to keep on saying, not every one of you. But once Judas goes, he doesn't say that anymore. He gets down to business. And he starts teaching, praying, caring for and preparing his disciples for when he leaves. See, that foot washing, that anticipates this other cleansing. Cleansing his own people who are in the world. Now, just so that you know that I'm not making all this up, here's at least one other commentary that points this out. Quote from another commentary. The disciples have a need for continual cleansing. That's illustrated by the foot washing. But also, the Lord's new community is cleansed by the exposure and the departure of the betrayer. Get Satan out and you're cleansing the people. See, once Satan has entered in, Judas has gone past the point of no return. Jesus commands him to move on quickly. John uses this great symbolism there. He went out and it was night. That seems to be like a vision or a picture of where Judas is at spiritually. So Jesus is the light of the world, but Judas is walking in the dark. Once Satan has entered in, once he's past the point of no return, Jesus says, be out. And he cleanses his people and casts him out. Actually, I was thinking about this during the week. Satan entering into Judas, that really got me thinking. Because it's quite a strange saying, isn't it? Like that Satan would enter into someone. And I sort of thought, could this ever happen to me? Satan entering into me? And I sort of spent the week just sort of pondering the verse. A few things. Satan entering into Judas actually happens in a couple of stages. In 13 verse 2, Satan first tempts his heart and strikes into his heart. Then Satan stirs him up to go to the authorities and make a bargain. And we learn that from Luke. Then Satan is said to enter into his life here. So just as someone might say, my faith grows, you know, I've always had faith, but now it's growing, or I was filled with the Spirit, I've always had him, the Holy Spirit, in my life, but looking back I can see I was filled with the Spirit for a special task. Just as someone could say, my faith grows, so this satanic influence starts to grow over Judas as Judas lets it grow over his life. The other thing to say is that it's not as if God is absent from that process. Along the way, God is taking away reason and sensitivity from Judas so that he may be fully handed over to Satan. Third thing you could say is that this verse is actually quite different from demon possession. Do you know that John's Gospel has no demon possession stories? I didn't realise that until recently, that Matthew, Mark and Luke often have people who are possessed by a demon, where a demon has come on them and now they do uncontrollable things and Jesus will cast out. There is none of them in John. So it's quite different from that, because Judas is actually very much in control, isn't he? He's not doing things that he can't stop himself doing, like you get in those demonic possessions. He's very much in control, even as Satan's influence grows. And so the other thing to say is that Judas and Satan are actually working together in this. John Calvin says, Judas lights the fire, but Satan fans the flames for this thing. Whenever somebody turns from Jesus and sets their heart against him, they can then be further hardened by Satan away from him, to go away from him even more, I suppose you would say. Satan's actions doesn't normally cause people to do crazy things like wear black nail polish, bite off chicken heads, listen to death metal music. The real thing that Satan does and wants to do is harden people away from Jesus. And so, yeah, Satan can come into people's lives in that sense, of them letting him in, letting his influence harden them away from Jesus. But Judas is also unique. He literally betrayed Jesus in a way that no one else did. Satan entering into him coincides with Judas making that final decision to go through with it. I'm going. There is no going back. He's past the point of no return. Jesus commands him, do it quickly. And it's a casting out. of Judas and a casting out of Satan from amongst his own. Guys, this is the lesson to learn from Judas. Jesus cares for his own who are in the world. He cleanses them in more ways than one, you know, forgiveness of sins, but also looking after and cleansing his people, actively taking away Judas and Satan in order to protect them, care for them, teach them, pray for his own who are in the world. Jesus cares for his own who are in the world. We should too. This Judas episode teaches us that. We should too. We too should be looking over and watching out for and caring for God's people, Jesus' people, his own, who are in the world, shouldn't we? Elsewhere, God's word says that we should seek to gently correct false teachers in the hope that they turn from their ways. So rather than letting false teachers just do what they like at church and say what they like and cause wrong beliefs about Jesus, we need to get in there quickly and gently correct them. Jesus cares for his own. We should too. And not just false teachers. Anyone who stirs up divisive, divisive issues. You know, these might be good questions even, legitimate questions. Questions that Christians genuinely kind of differ over. But if someone raises them up in a dividing way, so it's causing one group here and one group there, whenever somebody does that, that we should gently correct them in the hope that they turn from their ways. In the first place, it's obviously the church leaders who do this. And later on, Jesus will say to Peter, feed my lambs, watch over my lambs, protect my lambs. So he said, you're the leader. You've got to gently care for and tend my own who are in the world. So in the first place, it's the leaders who have this role as the gentle guardians. But, you know, all of it, no matter who you are, we all play a part in desiring and supporting and asking for leaders who will do this. And then keeping those leaders accountable to make sure that they do get on and do it, right? We all play a part in that. And, of course, leaders can't be everywhere all the time, and leaders certainly aren't perfect. So you too, even if you're not a leader, as you go through life, you're noticing your brothers and sisters are falling into sin or getting involved in strange teaching, and you're having a quiet word where you need to have a quiet word. You're gently avoiding harsh confrontation. And you're also congratulating and pumping people up when they are doing the right thing and they are promoting healthy and wholesome teaching. Jesus cares for his own. What does Judas teach us? We should too. You know, the only positive for Judas, he makes us want Jesus all the more. That was the only thing I could really get out of it. As we see Judas' betrayal, Jesus just shines out of the page. What do you see? You see he's patient. He's in control. You see that he's humble. You see that he's a servant leader. You see that he can really be trusted. So let me say that. Jesus can be trusted. Let's pray. Lord, what a great thing it is that even amidst this betrayal and what is a really troubling event for Jesus, he's full of anguish, we still see how in charge he is and we're still able to trust him. Even though he's going through these terrible days, somehow through his goodness and his humility and his servant leadership and his power, we're led to trust him all the more. So we thank you for him. We thank you that's the case, that we are led to trust him and lean on him even more, even in his times of difficulty. And Lord, we just pray that in our own times of difficulty and challenge, that we'd really let the control, the faithfulness, the humility and the servant leadership of Jesus tender to our needs. And we pray, Lord, that we too would be lifted up to trust him all the more. And we pray this in his name. Amen.